You are listening to a Triple Canopy podcast. To hear more, visit www.canopycanopycanopy.com.
And we're going to move on to our next episode, which is going to be a short talk between Ben Weisner of the ACLU, who is the director of the Speech Privacy and Technology Project of the ACLU, has been an advisor to Edward Snowden, and Gabriella Coleman, the author of our excellent new book on Anonymous. And they're just going to talk between each other, right? And
we're going to talk between each other, then we're going to take some questions. It's not going to take very long. It's a great party space, and there's a lot of alcohol.
Yeah.
Right?
And we have a lot to celebrate, because now, who has OTR and Jabber now? Woo! Yeah. People.
If you ever want to have a conversation with Edward Snowden, that is necessary but not sufficient. So you're step one along the way. It's a great honor and pleasure for me to be able to have this conversation with Biela Coleman, my colleague, Chris Segoyan, who I think it's fair to say, but for the grace of God, could be a character in this book, fondly refers to Biela as the Jane Goodall of Anonymous. And in this book, you'll see she spent many, many years in the jungles and savannas of internet chat channels, and we'll get there. Just to set a few basic sort of ground rules for this conversation, I think that too often in tech conversations, people are afraid to say what they don't know. And I would rather that there be people in this room who hear again things that they know well than there be people who are listening to things that they don't understand and are afraid to ask about. So I think that we'll start by just defining a little bit of terminology before we get into the conversation. And please, 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 no question is a dumb question if something that you heard you didn't understand. It's really, really important to make that an ethos of this community and not have people feel like technologists are condescending to them. And I think Biela's been great about that in this book. And let's make that the principle tonight. So just before we get into the, you know, what the hell is Anonymous? Where do they come from? What do they stand for? Who are they? What is a white hat hacker and what's a black hat hacker?
Hmm. So let's see. So I guess maybe we should start with what a hacker is.
Even better. Even better.
But unfortunately, it's not so easy to define. But I guess if I had to define it, you know, a hacker is kind of a technical aficionado, you know, really into the craft of computing. And they tend to kind of embrace certain qualities around cleverness and ingenuity and craftiness. But aside from that, there's many different ways to be a hacker. So you could be a hacker by writing open source software. So you believe that source code should be available for free. And then there's white hats and black hats who often dabble and deal with computer security. And black hats often come from a tradition where they're into exploring and infiltrating systems. So you can kind of break into them.
So for example, at DEF CON, people like to show off exploits. And what would be an example of a kind of black hat exploit that people would show off?
I mean, an exploit basically is a vulnerability in a computer system that then can be exploited so that you can enter the system. And there's very different types of exploits. And, I mean, black hats, I mean, it's interesting because some of them, you know, definitely have dabbled in the world of crime, but there's a black hat tradition which is about kind of owning systems and exploring systems, but really for the sake of learning and for the pleasure of exploring them. A kind of white hat, you know, tends to definitely do security work, but avoids breaking the law when they do their security work.
So maybe if we, just to make an example, you know, someone comes upon a serious security flaw, a vulnerability in a program, what does a black hat do with that, and what does a white hat do with that?
I mean,
oversimplify.
Right. I mean, yeah. A white hat will fix it. Or report it and patch it up. A black hat might sort of use it as an opportunity to explore the system. And they might, black hats might trade that exploit amongst themselves. Some might sell that vulnerability on a black market and make a lot of money. Others might sort of use it to you know, look for politically damning information that's in servers, right? I mean, that's the thing with black hats. There's also many ways to be a black hat,
right,
as well.
Right. So let's move on through a few more pieces of terminology and then get into the conversation. What is a DDoS attack?
A DDoS stands for Distributed Denial of Service Attack or Campaign. And it's pretty, you know, basic concept. I think we actually DDoSed some of the Jabber servers tonight, which is basically when you make too many requests of a web page or a server all at once, it can't handle the load, and so it becomes inaccessible. And there's many different ways to DDoS a server, but this is something that Anonymous specialized in for quite a number of years.
And people have very different ideas about the legitimacy of this tactic. We can get into it later. Some of my colleagues compare it to eating all of the cheese samples at Costco. Right? And others think that it might be a little more serious than that. Yeah.
And it is important to say that there's not damage to a server,
right,
when a DDoS happens, but it does cost money and resources to protect from a DDoS attack.
And it might prevent the target from using its website during that time.
Absolutely.
Right? So there might be other kinds of damage. And what is doxing?
Doxing. Doxing is basically when you reveal the identity, the real identity of a person who is otherwise concealed. And it could also mean revealing their private information, such as social security number, address, and phone number.
I'm going to move into the conversation about Anonymous now. The main reason why I asked those questions, the answers to which many of you, if not most of you, knew, is so that you will understand that you have permission to ask these kinds of questions and should interrupt us if the conversation gets too technical for you.
Oh, no. And, you know, the other day I was teaching a class and I was talking about trolls, and then one of my students, interrupted and said, "What's a troll?"
Well, let's start with what's a troll, because I want to ask you what Anonymous is, but actually that's an impossible question to answer. So the better way of asking it is, where do they come from? You know, in your book you say they come from the grisly underworld of trolling. What does that mean? And how did this thing begin to emerge?
So Anonymous was best known for its trolling antics, and for those that may not know, trolling also can take many different forms, but it's basically an activity that seeks to disrupt and cause mayhem. And again, it can use the individuals who engage in trolling can use many different types of tactics, and there's some both trolling groups, trolling individuals, and trolling hordes that kind of come into being. And Anonymous was a horde, a trolling horde, and it was a name that came out of the image board 4chan, which is a wonderful image board where, no, really, there's great deception.
She means full of wonders when she says wonderful, but yes,
I mean,
go ahead.
It has such a bad reputation, but really there's all these different kind of topical message boards, and there's very lively communities, but one of the things that it became very famous for was organizing these massive trolling raids or campaigns, and this name Anonymous became the name used to troll, and they became so famous for trolling that Fox News called them the Internet Hate Machine in 2007.
And if you could say that the modern civil rights movement began when Rosa Parks didn't give up her seat on a bus, would you say that Anonymous as a political force began when someone leaked a Tom Cruise video?
Yeah, I mean, in some
Tell
ways, we are here tonight because of Tom Cruise.
Tom Cruise, yeah.
And there was a very famous video of Tom Cruise, and it was an internal church video, and he's basically praising the church. And if you haven't seen the video, I actually do recommend that you Google it, because it's quite good. And, you know, the internet was enjoying the video, you know, quite a bit. And so they got really mad when Scientology tried to censor the video. They threatened websites and publishers like Gawker with lawsuits. And this
was... What was the video?
It was Tom Cruise cackling a lot and laughing and praising the Church of Scientology. Is really... Scientology and Scientologists are the only ones who can help others in the world, was, I think, the basic takeaway message. And, you know, when Scientology decided to kind of go after publishers, Anonymous thought this was a perfect opportunity to troll the heck out of the Church of Scientology. And to this day, I do think it's still its mothership kind of troll campaign.
But it really, in a sense, I mean, you sort of see this as the first time that it goes beyond antics to choosing what many perceive to be a legitimate target and using political tactics to try to take it on.
Yeah, it was...
Not all online, right?
No, and it was really surprising because this is when I jumped in because I had a super secret project about Scientology. So I figured, well, why not follow another kind of group of geeks and hackers who were targeting Scientology. I had a historical project from the 1990s. And all I saw was trolling. But basically, Anonymous published a very compelling videos where they declared war against the Church of Scientology. And it was done as a joke for the lulz, for humor. But a serious debate was initiated by that video, as well as by ex-Scientologists reaching out to Anonymous and saying, wow, you guys are really, you know, into your trolling. Why don't you stop your trolling and join the cause? And then they decided to organize a day of street protest. But it was a bit of an experiment.
Right.
But a lot of people showed up. Over 7,000 people in 127 cities. I think because a lot of people wanted to meet other people from 4chan because it is an anonymous image board and it's like you want to meet...
But truly anonymous.
But truly anonymous.
Yeah, yeah,
you can't accrue status or reputation. It's not pseudo-anonymous. So a lot of people at that first protest was like, oh my God, you're on 4chan, you love 4chan,
right.
I love 4chan, we're connecting.
Yeah.
But something happened when people showed up on the streets. A kind of political sensibility was born, and then the name started to be used for activist campaigns, which came as a huge surprise to me.
And you were already studying it at that point.
Yeah.
And now she used the term the lulz, and people, you have to be honest with me. If you don't know what she's talking about, you have to raise your hand. If you want her to defend this term lulz or to define it and to explain it, and if you don't raise your hand, we're just going to keep going, and that's it. I think we've set the right kind of tone here where no one should be afraid to raise their hand right now, but if you all...
You should try it. Yeah.
Okay.
What's the lulz?
Just for fun.
I know.
Not that he doesn't know. So he just wants to hear what you think it is. Yeah.
So the lulz actually was a term that a group of trolls that were chatting together invented. And these were like hardcore trolls, Jammeth and Weave, and Hep Kitten. Like, there was actually a moment where this term was born. And somehow, you know, it kind of was just uttered or typed in a chat room, and it's a bastardization and pluralization of laugh out loud. And it was meant to kind of capture a more sinister, dark, you know, almost evil side of humor. And trolls basically started to use the term lulz to explain why they targeted people. I did it for the lulz, for the humor of it. But it's kind of now a term that also encompasses more lighthearted forms of humor, but often humor that's very ironic or kind of insensible in some ways.
So after this experiment, I guess, with taking on Scientology, there seems to be an increase in political consciousness. Some members of Anonymous get involved in the Arab and African Spring movements. And then there's an even bigger moment when MasterCard and PayPal and others decide, in response to U.S. government pressure, to shut down contributions to WikiLeaks. And they begin an operation, essentially, to avenge this, to go after those entities, those huge, powerful corporations that have cut off donations to WikiLeaks. Now, you quote... the legendary John Perry Barlow, one of the founders of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, as sort of comparing this moment when Anonymous gets involved in this as, you know, as the shots fired at Lexington, the shots heard around the world. And I think that's a pretty extravagant claim by my friend John Perry. And I wonder if you stand by that and how you would describe that.
Yeah, I mean, it was an interesting moment because... when there was this banking and service blockade against WikiLeaks, again, people were pissed off, right? I mean, WikiLeaks had done some really interesting leaking and whistleblowing and they hadn't been charged with any legal wrongdoing, and yet through this kind of soft form of diplomatic pressure, you have the ability, the U.S. government has the ability to basically shut down a really important website. And what was really fascinating at the time was Anonymous basically, through a series of accidents, which I cover in the book, provided a platform or a place where this more diffuse anger can kind of be concentrated into a ball, a furious ball of fury, and kind of lobbed to a place, right? And that's precisely what happened. You had an incredibly large DDoS campaign, probably the biggest one that the web has ever seen. There was over 7,000 people that showed up on one chat channel, which is quite a bit. You had 100,000 downloads of this program, Low Orbit Ion Cannon, that could be used for the DDoS. And whatever you think of the DDoS as a kind of tactic, nevertheless, I think it was very valuable to take what was diffuse, but there, and make it much more potent and visible. And Anonymous certainly provided the kind of platform to make that happen. And then they were catapulted into like the national limelight.
If they were trying not to get caught, they did a terrible job.
They did
a
terrible job.
I mean, their security was awful.
Yeah, I mean, there was very little attention given to security for the DDoS at the time. There were
and
hackers.
One thing that is, I mean, do you think at that point that because there had not yet been serious prosecutorial efforts to go after this kind of behavior, people felt immune from consequences?
I think it was that, and then it was also safety in numbers. How are they going to go after 10,000 of us? You know, if there's 10,000 of us, we are safe. And that was literally one of the things that had been repeated on the channels. And I think also, rightly, when you're just like pressing one button on the computer at home, you don't feel like it's that big of a deal, right? Lo and behold, then the feds a month later show up at your door and, you know, truck out your computer equipment, and, you know, because you violated the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, it kind of is a big deal. But at the time, I think people felt that they were protected by the numbers.
Right, well, and one benefit of that, I suppose, is that from that point onward, at least people had a sense of what the threat environment was, what the risk was, and could decide whether they wanted to risk prosecution before taking those kinds of actions. They wouldn't be pulled into it. So I think we've gotten to where I want to ask you about what might be maybe the core claim of your book, which is, you know, as in your words, that Anonymous has matured into a serious political movement. And, you know, I have to say that from where I sit, I have a mixed reaction to that claim. And there are many times where I find myself cheering them on, and other times where I find myself repulsed and afraid by them. And that I think that you know, when I think about a political movement, I think about a coherent set of goals.
Mm-hmm.
I think about a common understanding about tactics. I think about a consensus about legitimate targets. And while your book extremely compellingly shows how all of these issues are debated within Anonymous, I think you have to judge a movement by its actions and not by its chat logs. And so the question for me is, how, if they are a serious political movement, what is that movement?
So yeah, they are. They pose a lot of challenges in a lot of ways because of the fact that, you know, anyone can take the name, and so that means some very different things have happened under the banner of Anonymous, and even one operation itself may embody, you know, four different types of tactics that even people within Anonymous don't agree with all of them, right? But I think, first of all, you know, it's sometimes conversations around digital activism treat digital activism as if it's a singular thing, but I think we have to, first of all, differentiate between different forms of activism. And what Anonymous brings to the table, first of all, I think, is protest politics more than anything, combined with a little bit of whistleblowing and leaking through its hacking. But, you know, that's what it does. It actually is a type of genre for protesting and bringing attention to issues. And there are some other kind of phenomena like black bloc tactics, which are similar to Anonymous insofar as, you know, people are anonymous. They kind
of... Contact tactics are, you know, people wearing masks at...
At protests.
Maybe throwing Molotov cocktails.
And throwing stones.
Yeah.
And, you know, it can take kind of... you don't know what's going to happen because a lot of the people who come together during that protest don't even know each other necessarily, right? And actually, people anonymous do tend to kind of know each other. So I think as a form of protest politics, there is a kind of coherence of tactics and methods, and also when they decide to kind of jump into the arena, because they're often reacting to certain world events. Like, they're triggered by what's happening in the world, right? And why is that not, you know, a legitimate form of kind of political protest? So that I would answer that at one level. I think the other element that is really interesting is that across the different political networks, there is this kind of commitment not to kind of seek fame or recognition for your actions. And a lot of people in Anonymous don't break the law, right? They can, and some people have violated this rule and have sought recognition for what they do. And in that way, or in that level, I think Anonymous provides a really interesting platform for people to come together to engage in political action where they seek no sort of status for what they do. And that's really powerful and that's really important. And that's, I think, one of the sort of important elements to Anonymous. And then finally, I would also say that, you know, one of the things that they do well is disobey, break rules, challenge authority. And it's important to kind of create spaces where people engage in this sort of behavior, and it does get kind of chaotic and have negative consequences sometimes.
Right, and
as well.
I think, you know, working as I do in the more mainstream of the civil rights and civil liberties community, I appreciate the value of a vanguard that does create space, but I do find that, that I would say almost categorically,
mm-hmm.
that I see a difference between they are taking on institutional targets, be they corporations and governments, and they're taking on individual targets, be they even accused rapists,
mm-hmm.
or you know, members of police departments, or others, where there is a, at least from a civil liberties point of view, a real wariness towards the mob pointing to any individual. There are debates about this,
mm-hmm.
in Anonymous,
mm-hmm.
right?
Oh, absolutely. And I think the vanguard question is an interesting one, because on the one hand, there is a technical vanguard in Anonymous. If you don't have certain skills, you can't, for example, be a hacker within the teams or run the infrastructure. But on the other hand, what's so odd about Anonymous is that it's not a vanguard. It's like you can just show up as a person and start to participate or kind of contribute art or manifestos, right? And of course, you're going to be more attracted to them if you're already geeky, right? Like, this isn't necessarily... But I don't believe any political world is actually open to all. It's always kind of culturally coded or rooted in kind of, you know, time and place, right? But I think that's weird. There's a weird technical vanguardism combined with a populism, which is why it spirals out of control. In fact, I think if you just had these small teams who work together, there would be a lot less kind of experimentation as a result. Yes, there's a lot of kind of debate about appropriate levels of, let's just say, doxing in Anonymous. I think most people agree that, let's just say, when a police officer pepper sprays someone, it's completely legitimate to splatter their name all over the place, and that's what journalists do.
So long as you get it right.
So long as you get it right. And
which is the core of due process.
Right, right. But journalists often get it wrong, too.
Yeah, they do.
Right? So there's many actors
yeah.
that do get it wrong. And then the part that is really, I think, inexcusable, which happened in one case, including family members, right, who are related to the police officer,
right.
who have nothing to do with it, right?
And
this is very, very contentious for, I think, obvious reasons, and also raises the false flag issue, too,
right.
which is, you know, someone in there kind of pushing this along. And in some cases, I think that's believable, but I also have met enough people, including Jeremy Hammond, who's featured in the book, who I often thought was an agent provocateur, because he scared the shit out of me, because he was
he's a genuine revolutionary.
No, he's in jail for 10 years, and he is, right?
Yeah.
But it's hard to tell when you're on the other side.
So there is a sort of generational moral panic around technology, and you kind of see it in a lot of efforts to, you know, to regulate. Congress in the 90s was passing indecency laws to protect children from sexual information or sexual predators, and you know, anytime something bad happens on Facebook, there's an effort to impose criminal law. But my question around anonymous is, how much of the fear of anonymous is that kind of irrational panic, and how much of it is legitimate?
Yeah.
You know, how good are they?
So,
and should I mean, so in a sense, their power comes from their skill.
Right.
And so either they have that power, in which case people should be afraid of them, or they people are overreacting to them and they don't have that power.
I mean, on the one hand, their power has been amplified over and over by, you know, media institutions who highlight their
not just media institutions. Actually, if you see in the Snowden leaks, there are a lot of NSA slides. There are slides from the Swiss intelligence agency that came out this week that have a chart of what the threats are, and they are terrorists, and they are foreign actors, and they are spies, and they are hacktivists.
Right.
But I mean, this is in the PowerPoint presentations of the world's most powerful spy
organization. But I will say that I do actually think that hackers who infiltrate corporations and governments do hold a tremendous amount of real power. One of the kind of underreported but fascinating hacks came not so long ago in Peru. The Latin American hackers have never stopped, and they kind of broke into government computers, released emails that showed, you know, deep corruption in the Peruvian government, and the cabinet was one vote away from resigning because these emails were leaked. And it's people either who are inside organizations like Snowden or outsiders who can infiltrate, who can then kind of snatch out this information that can have a huge political impact. And I do think that they're threatening for two reasons. A, they have the skills, and we've clearly seen that there's enough geeks and hackers willing to take the risk in the last 5 years. And I don't think it's going to go away. And there's a lot of geeks and hackers in the world, right? So at some level, that threat, I do think, is real.
Let me ask one more question, and then we'll open it up. One of the things that you do, I think, effectively in the book is that you sort of take on the popular image of Anonymous as just slightly overweight, under-sunlit, white guys in sweatpants sitting at their computers typing away, and show a different kind of diversity within the organization. On the other hand, you would not make the claim that Anonymous looks like this room.
No.
Because this room is at least 50% and probably more women. And Anonymous is what percent women, would you say? 2, 1, 5?
Chinology, which is the kind of group that protests Scientology, is nearly 50-50. But it's also the least technical.
Right.
When you had Anonops, which really took off, it plummeted. You know, I don't have an exact number, but
you couldn't because it's anonymous. But
right.
but what
lower.
What was it like? So because you spent since what 2008 in this world, probably know more about this world than anyone. Probably have been a better ambassador and explainer of this world than anybody else out there. It's not only that it's male; it's that to outsiders at least, it seems not just male but sexist. In the language that it uses. And, you know, how do you sort of see your role in this environment? I think that, I mean, for some of us, and I think that I would guess that this is a broadly progressive crowd, the idea that that there could be an all-male social movement that is, you know, more or less anti-power, is odd and very uncomfortable.
Yeah,
right.
It is, and it's.
Yeah.
I mean, part of the explanation is, you know, in my 15 years of studying black hat or hackers, I've never met a female black hat hacker, period, in or outside of Anonymous, and that's why there's not like black hat hackers in Anonymous, the female ones, right? That said, you know, there are definitely a lot of kind of geeks who are participating in Anonymous, and there were females, but probably not at the kind of numbers that one would want. And I also do think that it's a huge problem that, you know, we live in a world where so many forms of politics today are happening through you know, technical domains. In journalism, you know, you have all these new startups with, you know, folks like Nate Silver. It's very kind of programming heavy, data heavy, and you don't have females. In Anonymous, you know, it's very male. All the kind of organizations like WikiLeaks are hacker-based. And so it's a huge problem, but I also think it exceeds the hacker world in a lot of ways. You have the same problem in computer science departments. The peak computer science enrollment happened in 1985, and it's dropped since then.
In terms of gender equity.
In terms of gender equity. And so you both have to fix this kind of larger structural problem. And then definitely within the hacker community.
There's a cultural problem.
There's a cultural problem.
Right? In the hacker community. Right?
I mean, there is a problem in many sectors of the hacker community.
Right.
Open source, I think, has been fantastic in kind of dealing with this problem. The security and black hat world is much, much worse. And
right.
I don't think we can't lump all hackers together.
One of the technologists in my office says he doesn't go to DEF CON because that's misogynist. He goes to HOPE.
Exactly.
Because that's where people are more inclusive.
That's
so
right.
There is a, yeah.
There's differences. And it's just, you know, if you know, females have often been marginalized through stereotypes, so let's not do the same with hackers, all the while pointing out very specifically where there are the problems, right? And it's fascinating because one of the things, for example, that I encounter in my research is that there's a lot of queer hackers and transgender hackers and a ton of queer kind of folks in Anonymous, right? So why is that kind of form of diversity sort of there and gender is not? And I don't actually
question.
have an
and
answer.
Chelsea
Manning, you know?
Being in some sense one of the great examples.
Exactly,
right.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's a lot of gender bending, but not a lot of gender inclusivity. And so I think it is a question we have to kind of keep posing and pushing people on. And it's interesting because Jeremy Hammond, who has very progressive politics, you know, was resistant for many months. He didn't want to join Anonymous precisely because of some of these dynamics. And then after a while, I was like, screw it, I want to hack, you know, and do so with people who are politically minded, right? But I do think, like, his reluctance, you know, points to this larger problem.
Let's open it up.
So I have a question that directly relates to this last couple minutes of what you're talking about. I haven't read the book yet, obviously. I would like to know more about what you found watching and observing in the period from the arrest or attempted arrest of Julian Assange to Steubenville, and how the community reacted first to the sort of Twitter feminist reaction about the allegations against Julian Assange, and then all the way to Anonymous getting involved and really publicizing the Steubenville case and the case in California and the case in Canada, which were so similar, involved as suicides of the girls who had been raped.
Right. So that's a great question. And, you know, one of the things I did do is feature, like, the book has a lot of Anonymous people, but then I do feature people. And one of the people I feature is Mercedes Hafner, who's a young woman, really political, really trollish. But one of the reasons why I featured her is, like, she doesn't like Julian Assange, but she supported WikiLeaks and was against the banking blockade. And I just used her as an example because actually people's views of Julian Assange are kind of all over the place. They tend to have respect for what he did, but in the wake of the kind of rape allegations and other issues around him, it's just a mixed bag. And then, you know, it was a big surprise. I was surprised when they got involved in Steubenville because, you know, they're not really known for their progressive gender politics.
What did you remind people about Steubenville?
Steubenville concerned a rape case in Steubenville, Ohio, and there was a wonderful New York Times article about the case. And someone decides that, in fact, you know, one article is not going to be enough to bring justice to this issue and takes it on as an Anonymous operation and also starts to work with local female activists as well in Steubenville. They had a big falling out, but nevertheless, there was that kind of collaboration. And on the one hand, it was very successful for bringing tons of attention and sparking a national debate. On the other hand, the woman's name was leaked by this Anonymous activist, not very prominently, but it was, and that a lot of people got very pissed off at that. And then the the next two rape cases they got involved in were handled much more carefully. But I would say, you know, a lot of people in Anonymous have this idea that language is not sacred and does not hurt. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. So they're very comfortable with misogynist language, which, you know, is very naive at some level because language does hurt and wound. But I would say many of them do support progressive gender politics, which is why they got involved in these cases.
David Auerbach.
This also gets a little to what you're saying as well. This is actually, I wanted to just ask, get a real reaction to, these are some tweets from Your Anon Central from the Anonymous account on Twitter. There are two extremes to Anonymous, the white, privileged, prominently male, US-EU-centered Anonymous, and the rest of us worldwide. While many of the white, privileged, prominently male, US-EU-centered Anonymous focus mainly on lols and protecting their virginity, they somehow become the mouthpieces for the collective due to better access to the media, interviews, and panels on Anonymous. However, it is the Anons across South America, Asia, and the Middle East who seem to be doing all the actual heavy lifting and challenging oppressive states and corporations, standing up for everyone that needs assistance without questioning if they are moral fags or not. The Anonymous lives and breathes for resistance, revolution, and justice is the Anonymous we should be amplifying. They are the real internet hate machine and the final boss of the internet. My respect to that Anonymous and only that Anonymous.
That must be a welcome question.
Yeah. I mean, I think, first of all, the stuff going on internationally is fascinating. And it's not simply Latin America, it's Cambodia, Vietnam, Singapore, and people have been arrested. And it's also a good reminder that a lot of people have been thrown in jail around the world. But it's also the case that it is certainly the case that there is, especially in its trolling days and also in part with the activism, you know, white, middle-class Europeans and Americans. But there's also, you know, a lot of the PayPal 14 were not middle class. They're much poorer. They can't pay their fine. Their collective fine is $80,000, and between 14 people, they can't pay that. They're not middle class. And that's something really important to think about, you know? And the other thing, too, is that a lot of kind of participants in LulzSec, you know, were not simply white middle class Americans. There were Iraqi immigrants. There was a Puerto Rican here from, you know, New York City. There was someone who served time in Iraq, right? A soldier. I mean, it's just, again, to kind of push against some of the stereotypes that exist. But I think point well taken, like when you take a global perspective, it also starts to look different. And I think one of the shortcomings of this book is that it's very European, American-centric.
I just thought it was interesting that this was coming from inside Anonymous being broadcast to the world.
No, they can be remarkably reflective, you know, a bunch. But you're right, that doesn't necessarily translate into a reflective operation, right? But they are reflective about what they've done and their limits.
Sarah?
I was curious what you thought about the sort of tension between anonymity and accountability to the groups of people they feel that they are intervening on behalf of.
Yeah.
Ferguson was an obviously difficult example of this where there were a lot of people who had skin in the game in the most literal sense, and it didn't seem like they were at all in control of what Anonymous was doing, supposedly on their behalf, which they turned out to be wrong. And so, like, a central tenet of left organizing is that you're accountable to the people on the ground. And that's something that Anonymous almost by definition can't do.
Right.
And so I'm curious how you saw them negotiating that, or whether you thought they were doing that well. It seems like an obvious challenge.
Right.
Could people in the back hear the question?
Mm-hmm.
No one said no.
Okay. So I struggled with this a lot because you're right. With anonymity and secrecy, it's really hard to have accountability. But a couple of things I think have changed my mind about this. And first of all, I would never want a world where all forms of political activism, whether it's protest activism or more, let's just say, community building, would be, you know, would revolve around secrecy and anonymity. Like, that would be terrible. But I would really hate to see a world where there wasn't a place for anonymous political interventions, both because I do think that there is, just at a kind of philosophical level or ethical level, this importance of you know, trying to do things without seeking recognition, because we live in a society where that's like the main cultural ideal, and it often becomes very distorting for activists. And there's that. And then I also think, like, you know, I went somewhere yesterday, and in order for me to get into the building, you know, I had to be photographed. I think of another place where that happened, and I had to sign an NDA, and I had to give my ID. You know, we live in a world where we're completely, you know, tracked and surveilled, and the powers that be have the ability to de-anonymize everyone. So I do think that it is really important that there's a political movement that kind of symbolizes, you know, what we've basically lost and we may never regain, right? And it does mean that you can't have certain forms of accountability as a result, but it does kind of emphasize the importance of the fact that, you know, we're all being kind of tracked and surveilled at some level. And then added to that, you know, a lot of anonymous activity is illegal. You know, it's just flat out illegal. And how can you engage in the illegal activity, some of which I think is important, such as breaking into servers, without being anonymous, right?
But I mean, civil disobedience is technically illegal as well. And it seems like there are, you know, activist communities have built in over time methods for dealing with illegal activity that they want to nonetheless participate in for political ends, and ways of being internally accountable for those sorts of actions. And I wonder, like, I actually think that with anonymous there are probably ways to make that happen on a deeper level than it happens now, but it doesn't seem like that's a priority.
No, they're really committed to being anonymous, right? And, I mean, I think in terms of civil disobedience, you know, we often use the examples of non-anonymous forms of civil disobedience, but that's not, like, the only example. And I think, like, some people would be willing to be much more transparent about what they do if the punishment for their activities were analogous to offline ones, right? But with something like the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, you know, the consequences are so stiff.
Potentially, right.
Potentially.
Often these cases resolve in ways that seem reasonable, but in the beginning there's a lot
right.
of coercion because of the possible exposure.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And in some cases,
yeah.
I mean, like some of the guys that did only 2 years, which at some level is not so...
You should
so
never say only 2 years for
yeah.
nonviolent crimes.
Is not so bad. That's
yeah.
why I'm using scare
yeah.
quotes.
Yeah.
Have $250,000 fines
right.
now, right? And they can't get jobs either. So I think
right.
that's also, you know, part of the problem.
Part of the question, though, with accountability might not even require piercing anonymity. It just might require a different ethos where, I mean, there's no bat signal that goes up from the local communities. There's some conversation that takes place on an IRC channel.
Oh, no.
And then they all swarm in.
That's
right?
not true.
Okay.
Sometimes it's a bat signal. Sometimes they swarm in. I mean, at every
yeah.
moment it's
yeah.
different. And that's the difficult thing about coming up with, like, a universal sort of, like, statement.
Right.
Every operation arises under very different circumstances, and it's just these people with skills, they care about these issues, they tend to intervene. Now, one thing I will say, you know, Jeremy Hammond once bemoaned that they weren't like Red Hack. Red Hack is a revolutionary Leninist hacker group out of Turkey that's been in existence for 16 years, and they're super militant, they're super well-organized. You probably wouldn't have a Ferguson mistake with them, because it's like a well-oiled machine, if that
it's
makes sense.
It's funny to think about people in Turkey in 1998 forming a Leninist hacker group.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I mean, it's
yeah.
incredible.
Yeah.
Like, they're
yeah.
the most interesting
yeah.
hacker group, like, ever, I think. They're really hard to access. There's, like, a spokesperson you have to talk to, and there's one person, Anonymous, who's done some really interesting work with them, and Jeremy has worked with them. But they have things down, you know what I mean? But the problem goes back to this name that anyone can take. So even if there was the equivalent of Red Hack and Anonymous, you know, Ben could all of a sudden decide to dox the Ferguson police officer that was incorrect. And that's actually what exactly happened. There was a well-oiled team that was working very quietly, and then this one person, like, really haphazardly comes along and does it.
And named the wrong person.
That's right.
Yeah.
And
right.
this is a problem when you have this open source name at some level, right?
Yeah, and a risk that you take when you think that doxing an individual is a legitimate tactic.
As well.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, there's two things. Like,
right.
some is just like, is doxing okay?
Right.
And then
did we get it right?
Right.
Yeah.
So.
More questions? Yes.
I was just wondering about what you said about. So, in your experience, people are either white hat or black hat. Because I thought there's a lot.
No, there's gray hat as well, and there's again many different ways to be a black hat, and but I tend not to work on people who are just straight up criminals. Although some political hackers have dabbled in criminal activity, but they're serious criminal organizations that are huge, well-organized, who engage in a lot of cybercrime. And those are, I guess, technically hackers, but not the types that I look at.
What I mean is that a lot of people I know who work in information security have some kind of background in more black hat type stuff. And so, but is the same not true on the opposite?
With the white hats?
So the people that you've met in anonymous, or just strictly black hats.
Oh.
Is it a two-way street?
Right, right.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of the hackers have come from a transgressive tradition where they've infiltrated systems and have definitely engaged in the black hat world. There are definitely hackers who are like open source developers and really technically savvy, but have not in anonymous infiltrated systems, but maybe run infrastructure or are behind big Twitter accounts as well, if that makes sense.
It is strange. You go to DEF CON, which is supposedly the big counterculture hack convention, and two-thirds of the people work for contractors or work for the NSA or work for, they're hackers.
Right, which is, again, why I think, when you measure anonymous from that perspective, they are quite radical, because it is really interesting. Think about, a group of people who are not socially or economically marginalized. They've got pretty good lives, and then they decide to kind of put that all at risk to engage in their activity, right? In comparison to all the DEF CON people,
right.
Like what they're doing is
making
pretty crazy.
$175,000 a year.
Yeah.
But
in comparison to other kind of progressive traditions, it definitely looks different as well.
Will someone from either Verso or Triple Canopy tell us when to shut up and turn this into a party?
Yeah.
Meanwhile, we're going to take more questions. Any more questions? Sam?
Yeah, this might not be a very well-formulated question, but I guess so I hope you can help. I guess my idea of anonymous is that it's always been chaotic, obviously, but it's been generally friendly. Any one cause sort of obvious. There's anonymous versus some sort of power. Now, it seems quite recently on Twitter and elsewhere, there's been these kind of culture wars fights being played out in kind of a very public and unpleasant way, where one element of something like Gamergate, among all these other things, is intramural fights within the tech world and within even anonymous or 4chan, or where anonymous-like tactics are being used kind of against each other in this kind of way, where it becomes even more chaotic in a situation that really escalates from 4chan to Twitter, which is an obviously much more widespread service. Is this something that seems to be happening in your opinion, that these kind of that anonymous itself or its tactics are becoming much more available to a lot of different sides and just this whole thing is becoming much more complicated and messy and unpleasant?
Yeah, I mean, these tactics, which now, are sometimes identified with anonymous, are predate anonymous, and they were used by black hat hacker groups against each other in the 90s. And then in the 2000s, there were big, trolling groups that were doing this against each other. And then today, there is a kind of interesting public manifestation, in part because I think Twitter allows a certain type of translation or conversion, and David wrote a great piece in Slate about Twitter and Gamergate, right? And how that kind of flames the fire. So I think that there is a much more public dimension that's going on based on practices that have a 20-year history, right? But because, A, so many more people are online today than they were 20, 25 years ago, and then there's this medium, Twitter, that is just amazing for outrage, right? And is not great for conversation, actually. it does kind of make this problem worse. And it's been very interesting to see Twitter try to come up with solutions, right? And I was really pleased recently where they said, okay, we're going to try to do something about harassment against women that exceeds the block button, because that just doesn't work, you know? And so in a lot of ways, I think actually there'll be some interesting technical and social solutions that do come up, and we're in a phase where, you know, it's a kind of free-for-all, and there aren't any measures that are being taken, but they will be at some level. But yeah, it's the kind of massification of some of these tactics that have existed for over 25 years.
If there's one more question, we'll take it. Yes, Julie Anglin in the front row.
You know, when I was reading your book, it was just fabulous. I was lucky to have read it already. I was thinking about how it seems to me as an observer from the side that a lot of what is described sounds like vigilante justice, right? And in my mind, I wonder, is that because the internet has been such a rules-free zone, and like as it gets more regulated, we will see the end of this, or is it a symptom of something else?
So I think part of it is that it's a symptom of something else, which is great availability of data online. You know what I mean? It's so easy in some ways to engage in doxing and vigilantism precisely because of the forms of data collection and mining that you really explore in your book, right? You have this situation where there's a perfect situation for both surveillance and exploitation of this data to locate individuals. And then you combine that, I think, with a real sense that there's not often justice in this world. I mean, a lot of people who engage in anonymous may definitely be using wrong tactics, but there is a sense that the political institutions of contemporary life are bankrupt and corrupt, and it's better to take our own action than to rely on them. So you have those two that combine, and you have like the perfect storm for kind of this everyday populist vigilantism that we see here and we see in many parts of the world, right? In China, the human flesh machine, right, is precisely happening quite a bit, where people are often targeted. And it's often very political in nature, my understanding. I mean, sometimes it's, you know, one person who is targeted because, you know, in Korea they allowed their dog to poo on the street and this was, you know, terrible and they go after them. But in many instances, it is targeting political corruption and there's no available channels to do anything else. So
let me thank Triple Canopy, thank Verso, and thank Biela. This was a really terrific...